Welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne, here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, we'll spend a lot of time on the East and West Coast. 2024 will mark the 25th anniversary of the Marshall decision. That's when the Supreme Court of Canada affirmed the hunting, fishing, and gathering rights promised to New Brunswick's Indigenous peoples should be respected.
These land claims are going to be defined how our resources, our timber resources, crown lands, and minerals and are shared between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. So basically, we're moving to a new treaty agreement in the Maritimes.
A LGBTQ plus organization receives funding to build the first transitional two-spirited housing project in Halifax.
It's set to for people to come to have a stable place to stay while they look for much more permanent housing.
The invasive green crab is threatening native ecosystems in the Salish Sea off the BC coast. A local project set up to protect marine life expands on Cortis Island.
It's like a marine treasure hunt. Last year we were finding tiny baby octopuses, we were finding tiny flatfish, we were finding really small squid. Just beautiful. You know, when you look in the water, you can't see those things at all until we get pretty close up.
And the Food Sharing Project says food insecurity is at an all-time high in the Kingston region. The organization wants more funding from Ottawa. This and a little more on Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Happy to have you with us. The invasive green crab is threatening the ecosystems of the Salish Sea off the BC coast, and the Friends of Cortis Island is expanding on the Light Trap project to detect the green crab species progression. The project, a collaboration with the Hawkeye Institute, requires volunteers to check the traps as they look for the valued native Dungeness crab and its invasive relatives. Helen Hall, executive director of FOCI, describes the opportunity as a marine treasure hunt that could result in tons of other fascinating discoveries apart from the crab monitoring. The hope is that the data will continue to see a thriving diversity of marine life in the traps. Here's Lonely Taylor on Cortis Island.
FOCI is looking for volunteers for a special light trap project. Partnering with the Hawkeye Institute, FOCI will begin this project on April 15th, and I caught up with Helen Hall to find out what the Light Trap project actually is.
Yeah, sounds intriguing, doesn't it? Light traps. Yeah, it's interesting how we use different equipment to find out different things in nature. So the Light Trap project is a project, as you mentioned, with the Hawkeye Institute. And what it is about, dropping light traps into 20 different locations in the Salish Sea. So you put them down, they glow at night, and what happens is they attract different larvae to them. You can get a whole bunch of different larvae, all sorts of small critters living in the ocean. But what we're after is two crabs. One is the Dungeness crab, which has declined significantly across its range, and the other one is the invasive green crab. So a good crab and a bad crab, if you like. We did this project last year, and what we did and we're doing this year again is we're putting the light trap on the side of Cortez Bay near the Seattle Yacht Club. And we're looking for volunteers. It's quite intensive work. We need to look at the trap every 2 days and record what we're seeing. And it's really good fun. It's like a marine treasure hunt. So we'd love people to volunteer for it. It's a really good way to show children what's in the ocean too. And last year we got all sorts of quite incredible finds as well. We did get a few Dungeness crab. That's what we were looking for last year. This year we've added in the invasive green crab. That's why Hawkeye want both crabs recorded. But last year we were finding like tiny baby octopuses. We were finding tiny flatfish. We were finding really small squid. Just beautiful critters that we were putting them out on Facebook and everyone was like, wow, that's really cool. And Mike Moore and Kate Madigan were helping coordinate last year. Mike posted some of his pictures on Tideline, and I think people were just fascinated by, you know, when you look in the water, you can't see those things at all until you get really close up. And we literally had a teaspoon, and these little tiny octopus was sitting inside a teaspoon. So really amazing, fascinating project. And we did have volunteers last year, and some of those are going to return. They love doing it, but we need more volunteers this year. As you can see, it's quite an effort. We will probably have the trap running from the middle of April, probably right through to August. Fun, interesting. And people are interested in volunteering, they can just phone us on 935-87 or email us on friendsofcortez@gmail.com.
And you said that project is located in the Cortez Bay neighborhood?
Yeah. If you live nearby, it's probably going to be easier to do. Anyone living in around Cortez Bay, but if anyone really wants to come, they can anywhere on the island, that would be really good. And the project, again, what's great about that project, we're partnering with the Haka Institute, so all the data goes back to them, and they're working right across the Salish Sea to see what's happening with the crabs and to get some information on what's going on. Why is one crab declining, and where is this the invasive green crab? You're very concerned about that crab coming onto Cortez. And actually last year we had the Department of Fisheries and Oceans had somebody come and do a slightly different related project with the crab. They actually set traps for the crab, the actual adult crab, in Manson's Lagoon and Coulter Bay. And luckily we didn't find any. It was a funny project where you're looking for something and actually don't want to find it. It's the opposite to what we normally do. And we didn't find any, but what is happening with that crab is it's spreading up the coast. It's in the Campbell River estuary. So every chance it could get onto Cortez. If it gets onto Cortez, what the DFO would do, if we do find with the trapping project, which we did last summer with the DFO, we're also repeating that as well as looking for the larvae with the light trap project. And if we find them, they will send over a team of people to eliminate them. They're that worried about it.
What kind of impact do these crabs have on our native ecosystem?
They're one of the most invasive and harmful crabs in the world. And they basically wreck the marine ecosystem, which everything else depends on. So they wreck all the vegetation. So they're really damaging, really harmful. And that would have a knock-on effect on other marine critters living in those habitats. Yeah, not a crab that we want to find here.
Lonnie Taylor.
You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
It's been 25 years since the Supreme Court of Canada overturned the convictions of Donald Marshall Jr. and in doing so, affirmed the hunting, fishing, and gathering rights promised to Indigenous peoples in the Peace and Friendship Treaty of 1760 and 1761. These days, with three different title claims laid out by First Nations in New Brunswick, the significance of the Marshall decision has never been greater, and that's why Indigenous elders, scholars, fishers, lawyers, historians, and economists, among others, met up a few days ago at Mount Allison University for Rough Waters, a two-day workshop looking at the legacy of the Marshall decisions. Rough Waters provided a space to discuss the past and future impact of the Marshall decision. Why were the Marshall decisions worth coming back to and studying? Mount Allison University professor Mario Lévesque answers that question with journalist Erica Butler, based in Sackville, New Brunswick.
It's very much worth paying attention to and studying, because when you take a look about it, it's reassessing our relationship with Indigenous peoples in Atlantic Canada. For over 150 years, we've basically pushed them and marginalized them in terms of their own economy and also their participation in the broader economy. And what the 1999 Marshall decisions said is the fact that their historical treaties are still in full force and effect. And so when you're thinking about this here, then, is we have to adjust our economies, adjust our practices to include them fully in things as they are, have a full right to be included in. So from that perspective there, it's about resetting the relationship and rebuilding that relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. And it goes back to the actual treaties of 1760-61. These are the peace and friendship treaties that I am talking about here. And in those treaties, basically, it wasn't about a cessation of land. What it was is the fact that we had agreed at that time to live together over the same territory in peace and friendship, so to share the land in here and to share its resources. And for too long, we've not been doing that. But since 1999, we've started to do a little bit of a better job in regards to the fishery. So for this here, the implications of it are is that it's not just about the fisheries here. Well, the workshop here is about the fishery, but more broader is about Indigenous, non-Indigenous relations in the Maritimes, which has great significance in New Brunswick at the moment, I must add, especially with three land claims that have been filed with the courts and the government in here. These land claims are going to be defined how our resources, our timber resources, crown lands, and minerals and are shared between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. So basically, we're moving to a new treaty agreement in the Maritimes.
Yeah, so people might associate the Marshall decision with the idea of fisheries, but really, as you say, this really can impact, you know, how we think about this legal relationship and what the peace and friendship treaties mean to, you know, today. And like, as you say, the future of the, you know, these negotiations that the New Brunswick government might be going into with the First Nations, both the Willistiqua and the Mi'kmaq, I guess.
That's absolutely correct in here. And basically the goal here of this workshop is the fact that 2 years ago I got together with my co-editors, the Honorable Graydon Nicholas, and also Dr. Ken Coates, and we wanted to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Marshall decisions, which is next year, 2024. And so we decided to do a special issue of the Journal of New Brunswick Studies on this topic. And so we issued a call for participation for papers to explore different issues, where we are today, what other steps we need to take for a more equitable resource allocation between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, and to explore the historical treaties and the actual relationship. Along the way, we said it would be a great idea to bring our contributors to the special issue together in a workshop to explore their contributions and to debate the issues. From there, then, once the workshop is over, we will submit our papers for external review. Once that process is completed at the end of the year, then it'll be submitted for publication, and the final issue of the journal is going to come out in 2024 on the 25th anniversary of the Marshall decisions. Especially in New Brunswick right now, and more broadly the Maritimes, but in particular in New Brunswick, First Nations communities and government relations has deteriorated over the past 4 or 5 years. They don't want to do land acknowledgements, or they have restricted land acknowledgements. They don't want to call in public inquiry into systemic racism into our judicial system in here that against Indigenous people. They did not even want to recognize September 30th, the National Day of Reconciliation, at the New Brunswick government. And and again, they ripped up the tax sharing agreements between First Nations communities and the New Brunswick government. So, you know, we need more positive news here. We need to develop some spaces for people to come together to discuss things, to explore the issues in here. And it's only through this discussion where we can try to resolve the issues. It's one venue where we can at least start this discussion and explore some of the issues that are at the heart of the conflict.
That's Mount Allison Politics Professor Dr. Mario Levesque.
Erica's complete conversation with Mount Allison University Professor Mario Levesque is available to you on canada-info.ca. Quickly drop by Kingston, Ontario to meet up with journalist Alexandra Fernandez and to hear a little more about the Food Sharing Project. Brenda Moore, chair of the board of directors for the Food Sharing Project, is frustrated with the federal budget released in March and the lack of funding for a national school food program. The Food Sharing Project has been providing nutritious food to schools across the Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington regions since 1985. Mrs. Moore says food insecurity is at an all-time high in the Kingston region. One of nine families in the area experienced food insecurity. Alexandra Fernandez spoke with Brenda Moore.
So there's been a national conversation about a national school food program for the last few years. And in fact, there is a line in the budget, in the federal budget, that says national school food program. And what organizations like Food Sharing and the Coalition for Healthy School Food and Breakfast Club of Canada have been doing for the last year is trying to tell our story and make sure that there is a dollar amount designated to the budget. We were very hopeful this year that in the federal budget there was going to be those dollars attached, but unfortunately that didn't happen. So over the next year, we will be continuing those conversations and advocating greatly, in all areas, across the community, across both federal and provincial governments, to help support food insecurity. We can't do it just through not-for-profits. We need help from both levels of government. One-third of our funding comes from the provincial funding, from the provincial government through the Student Nutrition Program, but that funding hasn't increased since 2014. So we need the provincial government to step up, we need the federal government to step in, and together we can all work together to help make a difference for so many families all across Canada. In 2019, before the pandemic started, the Food Sharing Project was delivering $12,000 worth of food every week to schools. This winter, that number is now at $25,000. We have never experienced the rate of increase that we are dealing with now between 2019 and 2023. Every week it grows. Every week school coordinators are calling us and apologizing for increasing their orders because the kids are just so hungry. And while we're supposedly on the other side of the pandemic, the lingering effects of the pandemic on families is very significant. So with our buying power, the Food Sharing Project can provide food for a student at school for $2 a day. And that is the great thing about being the source for all the groceries that go into schools. So when somebody makes a donation to the Food Sharing Project, we take that money right to our local suppliers, and that bulk purchasing really stretches your donation.
Thank you so much, Brenda, for joining me to learn a little bit more about the Food Sharing Project, how people can get involved, and for speaking about the importance of food programs in schools.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Alex.
The Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance has just received government funding to build and manage the first Two-Spirit transitional housing project in Halifax. Two-Spirit, a term coined back in the late 1980s, is used to describe LGBTQ+ members who are Indigenous. The new housing development is part of Canada's National Housing Strategy. Ensuring housing is a major issue across the province. The new project will take about 6 months to a year to develop and operate, and will take place either in Halifax or Dartmouth or Sackville if nothing is available. And it could be the first step toward building different projects across the province. Ms. Sarah Gouda is in Halifax, Nova Scotia. She spoke with Tama Young, a Two-Spirit Mi'kmaq lawyer from Murrumbidgee and co-founder of the Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance.
The priorities for Two-Spirit people, and it would, you know, it's 6 to 8 units. It's a transitional house. It's set to for people to come and who are in need of immediate housing to have a stable place to stay while they look for much more permanent housing. So it's that's really the intent of it, really. And it is fully intended for Two-Spirit people and for members of the Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance. And the first priority list would be, I would imagine, Mi'kmaq, Wolastoq, Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Two-Spirited people. And to me, that's only the first step. You know, housing is such a major issue that we have another group up here. I live up in Numagi, Cape Breton. We have another group up here. We're going to be looking at some senior housing for seniors, 2S LGBTQ folks. And we're the sky's the limit, or we're blue skying, as they say. We're looking at maybe, you know, tiny homes, maybe small two-bedroom units, one for an elder, one for a youth that can help each other. And, you know, it could be people are thinking co-ops, creative communes, et cetera, type of thing, all the different political stripes. But the key point is that it's housing, and housing for seniors that may need it, you know, up here, you know. Working in collaboration with the Elderberries, which is the elder group of 2S LGBTQ folks in Metro Halifax. We have a branch up here in Cape Breton too. So that's the other one, but we'll also be able to spin it off. I'm also looking towards the future of looking at how do we get housing in the communities, in the reserves, you know, like a lot of two-spirited people don't have access to housing, they're never even placed on the housing allocation list. The real culprit there is not the chief or the councils or the folks or anything like that, or even the housing policies, etc. The real culprit there is resource management. There's not enough houses allocated, you know, not enough houses for anyone, really. And like, for example, I think of one community that they may get about 10 houses per year, but the need is that they need 400. And for a lot of two-spirited people, we'll never be able to be on that priority list, you know, because there'll be always somebody who quote unquote needs a house more, or is allocated a house more than we know. Let's say a single two-spirited man who identifies as a gay man, who has no children, who's the uncle, right? Or it could be the two-spirited lesbian who has maybe one or two children, a single mother, but you know there'll always be single mothers who have more children, you know, who need the house more. So we need more resources. And that's what we really should be all working towards, is housing for everyone. Housing generally is a provincial jurisdiction, but among First Nations communities, it's a federal jurisdiction. And we're looking at the collaboration with all the three levels of governments, you know, between the federal government, provincial government, and also Indigenous governance, you know, both on and off reserve. You know, we all need to sit down and say, you know what? In the scarce allocation of resources, what can we do to do this? No, basically, the Canadian housing strategy is a great start. It identifies as a housing as a priority, and it says this is how much is needed. And it takes into consideration all the different types of housing that's really needed. Affordable single family dwellings, you know, in major cities, apartment units, you know, co-op housing, even tiny homes for creative stuff in northern, you know, First Nations communities. So, and it allocates a budget stuff. And that's where really, that's where we need to lobby much more extensively and hard.
Curtis Island Waste Management Center off the BC coast is preparing for a busy summer, and the organization's new manager is worried about capacity. Manager Aaron McCulloch Gary says everything is running smoothly at the moment, but he has serious concerns about the upcoming summer season when the Curtis Island population triples beyond its 1,000 year-round residents. He's especially concerned about trucks accessing and leaving the island to deal with solid waste. McCulloch Gary says they're an essential service and should receive priority loading on both the Curtis and Quadra Island ferries. Craig Osoba spoke to McCulloch Gary.
It's been about 100 days, Aaron, since you took over. I guess it was the beginning of 2023. How's it been going for you?
Seems to be running smoothly.
All right. And have you had to change any procedures or systems, or how are things functioning at the moment?
I think most everything is functioning the same as it always has, except for the change in the free store hours.
Okay. And now as we are in the spring, of course, the island's population can even triple once the busy summer comes along. What are your biggest challenges as we ramp up for the summer season? season?
As far as the free store is concerned, we're going to change the hours back to Monday and Wednesdays starting at the end of May.
So just because of traffic?
Just because of traffic, yeah. It gets way too crazy in here. There's not really enough room for all the cars. And people coming and going from the free store combined with all the extra traffic just coming to do garbage and recycling. It just overwhelms this place and it makes it not even safe sometimes. You've got lots of kids coming and running around and dogs and should stay in their cars. But just for safety more than anything, we decided to split it up so that during those busy months, the free store is open at a different time.
Okay. And any other challenges as the population increases? How about just waste removal? For example, the stuff, the solid waste that has to be shipped off the island. We don't have a landfill on Cortez.
No, we don't. So we're actually a transfer station. We don't leave anything here. Everything that comes here leaves. In bins and on trucks. And let's see, the truck driver mentioned to me that he was curious as to why the food trucks get priority loading on the ferry, yet the waste does not.
And it's equally critical.
If not more.
Yeah, just for the functioning of the... What could happen if waste backs up at the recycling center?
Let's say trucks couldn't get to us to remove the bins that are full, at that point, waste would end up being piled on the ground, and then animals would get in it, and it would fester and create potentially biohazardous situations, and along with stink and visually ugly, and just not the way we want to run this. At a certain point, we would have to close the facility.
Who would you lobby? Is it the Comox Valley Regional District that you're under the tutelage of? Or who would you lobby to say to ensure that those trucks are able to get to and off the island?
I'm not sure which entity is directly responsible for that. It could be, in the end, it could be a BC Ferries. It could be a regional district. My contract is with the Comox Valley Regional District, but our regional director, Mark Vonish, is with the Strathcona Regional District. So there are different divisions of regional, of municipal governments dealing with different aspects of this place. So I'm not positive who gets to make that call when it comes to priority loading involving the ferries.
But you'd like to see it happen.
I think it would make more sense. We have had the truck drivers get overloaded and have to miss picking up bins in the summer. And even in the summer when it's busy, our bins fill so quickly that one trip not coming here makes a huge difference. It would make the difference of garbage being put on the ground instead of in bins or not.
That was Craig Osoba on Cortez Island off the BC coast. That's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, Sarah Gouda, Loni Taylor, Erica Butler, Alexandra Fernandez, and Greg Osoba, National Editor Maureen McEwen. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Great to have you with us. Stay tuned to the show that follows. Until next week, ciao.
Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.